Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Part of what I wanted to bring into this conversation is first-generation people have both privileges and challenges. And this is something that my sister and I talk about all the time. It was only right to bring my beautiful, brilliant sister, Malika Hodge, into today's episode. Being first-generation, you're not tainted in the harms of this country. Like, you haven't been wrapped all the way in it. So when you come here and what your parents tell you about that, like, you're just starting off the generational cycle here. And I don't think people fully understand how harmful this place is the longer you stay here over time. So there was like a protective shield because of being like, you can't waste opportunity. Look what happened. Like, look at these Black Americans that are standing outside the building, you know, growing up in the projects. Like, look at these people that don't go to school and are drinking and all of these things. And sometimes you're judging the individual. On the season of The Labyrinth of the First Gen, we will explore a conversation about what we carry with us and what we redefine. We are pioneers just by simply existing. My name is Malika. I'm based in the Bronx, New York. I consider myself like a humanization strategist. So although I fall into this DEIA umbrella, which I still have a lot of feelings about why it doesn't feel completely right to categorize my work that I do as that, I guess that's how most people would understand it. Very, very passionate about creating safe spaces everywhere for folks, especially in work environments for folks that are historically underrepresented and continuously oppressed. I love health equity work, really love thinking about healthier environments, how to make sure people are given good options in life. I think that's really important. I love writing, love speaking, love learning. You describe yourself as a humanization strategist. Can you talk about the work that you are currently doing and what exactly does that mean? Yeah, of course. Like, to be honest, you know, I really think I'm happy there's a language for some of that work now, but I think that's it's kind of been co-opted and corporatized. Everybody now says they have a diversity, equity, inclusion. Diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice idea. They're calling it all these acronyms. In a sense, I'm happy that there's more opportunities for people to get paid for this work that sometimes we feel we have to do, because if we don't come in saying that this is restrictive and here's how and why, nothing really shifts and changes at all in these work environments. So I definitely think our discomfort causes us to often do free labor to make the environment a little bit more palatable for the people that are there and the people that are going to come after. But, you know, there's so much labor that we've done that we have not been paid for in creating that in those spaces. There's also deep responsibility and being tokenized and being tasked to solve a problem that you don't cause. So I think there's just this web, this like matrix of things that are just like, that is so complex, as often really looking about like, what is it about the conditions of this country, the conditions really of colonization that lead to, you know, the institutions that we continue to build, where we start to see those same kind of like imperfections that cause real harm. And so this definitely, you know, it influences the work that I want to do, because I want it to be better for the people that come after me. Some people made it their responsibility to make sure that I'm able to enjoy what I have now. We have to continue to take it a step further.
Malika talked about how doing this work, when we're thinking about advancing places in the workplace and making a safe environment, it is not separate from the social, economic, and political climate of the United States, and how that directly really influences work environments and workplaces.
Although the pendulum, they find ways to swing it back, right? You look at like Republican lawmakers now banning, banning, you know, like Democratic legislators and stuff, like, you know, like the undoing of voting rights and all of these things that's happening to make sure that the system stays as it's supposed to be. But I think Black resistance is so powerful. And the more that I'm able to travel and see it and understand, Black American resistance stories inspire others to take it a step further too. I think I really learned that in Paris, right? Like really seeing how these folks from all over Europe are like, yeah, like we're looking at what Black Americans are doing as a way to kind of inspire our movements here, because they're further behind in some senses in those places. So yeah, I think the work's incredibly important. I think it's almost impossible for, as a conscious person, to not be a part of that work in some capacity, to really figure out how to open more doors for yourself and others.
I love that you mentioned really the global perspective and importance of resistance from the Black community and in the United States particularly, and how that influences places elsewhere. And something that, you know, you mentioned around this like power of Black resistance, right? So I also want to ask a follow-up question. How do you describe your race and or ethnicity? We kind of got a sense of that.
I'm Garifuna. I'm also West Indian. Places I'm from, being a Garifuna, because Garifuna people is not confined to just one place, but primarily Belize. We have some heritage also in Guatemala and in Honduras as well. That's still meant to be kind of like uncovered and excavated as well. U.S. Virgin Islands, and you know, we found that recently that our dad's father might have been from, maybe he wasn't from the U.S. Virgin Islands, maybe he was from another island like Antigua or something like that. So that was also interesting to note. I consider myself to be proudly Black, although my heritage is not really rooted in the African American story, but more in the larger kind of Caribbean and Latin American context.
When you hear the words first generation, what comes up for you?
I think first generation, I feel like the first ones to kind of break maybe barriers in the U.S. on U.S. soil. But I also think you can be the first one in your generation when you break any type of barrier that hasn't been seen before. I think that's also another way to look at it, which I like the way you had described it as well in your quest to really figure this out. For me, it's immense kind of like gratitude, because it's such a luck factor, right? Sometimes you sit with like what if my parents didn't find their way to New York City? And there's so many people, I still know people and have people that I hold dear to my heart that are trying to enter this country for opportunities, and being able to be born here gives you a global entryway into the whole world in a sense, right? So I think about that, but I also think about the immense responsibility and the weight of that too.
Malika also emphasized the importance of recognizing her own identity as someone who has parents with immigrant roots, and also how it intersects the history and or the sacrifices of African Americans in the United States.
However, because I live in this country, I feel like, and I've benefited from the trials and tribulations of folks that are from here, I have deep gratitude for it, but I also understand that my experience is different. I think this informs my work because I don't think people are one-dimensional.
I feel like it is definitely the case when it comes to Black people. People often make the assumption that the Black identity is not dynamic. And I'm speaking about that from the perspective of the United States in particular. So when people say, are you, you know, Black, or, you know, they can see that you are visibly Black, they could see that there's often no other question, right?
I don't even like the references to, like, African Americans being, like, quote unquote, regular Blacks or all of those things, because there is stories there, right? And there's variations and there's things to excavate there too. And when I was working with students, when I was teaching in a high school years ago, that was something that I would talk to the young people about, because they were just like, I'm just Black. And I'm like, what does that mean? Right? Like, where are your people from? What's their story? How did you arrive in New York? Where are some of your connections? Because we forget that there's all of these ethnicities and different things that are here too. So people forget that Blackness does not mean that you don't have an ethnicity. And I notice people flattening identities in general, which makes it really hard for us to think about how do we build spaces for both visible and invisible differences that people might have. So I think that it's a really interesting layer, because I'll be in a space and depending on where I am, people may not know that I have an immigrant background and they forget to add that layer, right? Or how that layer contributes to this fabric too. So I think that has really kind of influenced me to really think about my Blackness, but also in some of the ways, because we're trained to do this to each other, what are some of the ways that I do that too, right? As we look at this. And the assumption, right, that there's not Black people who speak other languages, who speak Spanish, like the surprise people get when I speak Spanish, that I was like, why are you surprised? And I'm taught some of that stuff too, because sometimes because of the lack of representation, especially with within the Latinidad context, we forget how many Black people are there. We forget the full dynamics of the transatlantic slave trade. And not just confined to that, because there were Black people that were here that were not part of the slave trade too, right? But Blackness is not just an American thing, right? Like, there's Black people all over the world, even in Asia.
Something that is coming up in this conversation is the differences between race and ethnicity, as well as the intersections between race and ethnicity. And I was wondering if you can talk a bit more about how you define the differences and the nuances of race and ethnicity.
I think that's an interesting question within the U.S. context, because sometimes the way we categorize things also misses a lot of things. I'm very proud to consider myself Black. I'm a Black, visibly Black woman. And I'm also ethnically, right, Garifuna. I'm ethnically Central American, right, West Indian. So there's all of those enclaves too. So I think racially we're looking at the categories that the U.S. confines us to, Black, white, you know, Asian, Latino or Latina, and X, which is very interesting because that really crosses a border into ethnicity. So ethnicity, I think, helps to add that other dynamic and layer as to where are you kind of even culturally from, right? Maybe sometimes even like what languages and cultural practices you practice at home, what languages do you speak? I see ethnicity as a deepened lens of the cultural enclaves that we may be a part of. And I see racial categorization, because the brain likes segmentation. So it helps folks to just kind of pinpoint and put folks into some categories. And also sometimes a lot of that goes based on phenotype, right? And then the struggles of what if you don't even look like the phenotype that you check off the box, right? And sometimes you can be multiple things. People are, you know, biracial Blacks and all of these things. And so it can be very limiting, but I think race is the bigger bucket and ethnicity is like the smaller kind of more nuanced variances that happen or that explain some other components of our identities.
Malika talked about sometimes again, because people are not understanding the dynamics of the differences between race and ethnicity, and even the intersections of race and ethnicity, there are some exclusions to understanding that additional layers as well.
There's times where I've been in all Black groups where I'm like, like, because this is not, we're not talking about Blackness in a dynamic way, I'm not feeling seen and heard. And there's a lot of assumptions being made about what Black is, and it's not a very Pan-African sort of view, right? Like, that Blackness is global. And that's something that, like, a project that I would like to work on, right? Like, Blackness is a global phenomenon. It's not just confined to the way we put it into a box in the U.S. Because even the way we confine it in the U.S. is very limiting, too, right? Like, I think about stories about, like, the Gullah people, for example, like, all of these stories. I was reading Rusta's Resistance, and she was talking about not just in Jamaica was there a Maroon story, right? Black people who are fighting against, but there's Maroon stories all over the world about Black people who said no, right? So that was like a really interesting concept too, because usually I think Maroon and I think Jamaica, right? But like Maroons being a cultural phenomenon and many Black people, Harriet Tubman, right? And a Black American Maroon, you could say, or an African American Maroon.
We spoke about how there are assumptions around Blackness is, but also those assumptions come from within our communities as well.
I think about every time there's some sort of like affinity group or Black people coming together, there's not the assumption that there's global stories to be uncovered in the space. And so I want to be able to honor and celebrate soul food and all of the things people typically affiliate Blackness with, but that's not all of it, right? Like, so sometimes we make that assumption that everybody's eating soul food at home, right? For example, I was a part of an affinity group where they did like a Black bingo, and a lot of the stories were very confined to like those kind of experiences of being like descendants of like American Blackness. So that was, it was like interesting. I was like, huh, this is really interesting. And when we don't have a more, I think, involved or integrated conversation about what this could look like, I think we lose the ability to feel truly connected to each other. You know, like, because as I uncover the stories and I continue to read, because there's so much to read about even understanding Black people who made it possible for me to be here on this soil. Like, I just, you know, there's so many things that we weren't taught that shit in school. And there's also, you know, that's why they're banning books and all that other stuff, because they didn't want us to learn those things. But then you start to see the connections, right? You start to understand the full story and the full picture about like the lack of representation of Black people all over the world. And I think when we're not really making a constructive assumption that like there's layers to the Blackness in all spaces, we leave people to the side. And so that's really hard too. We lose those stories, like Shirley Chisholm, like from Barbados, right? Like arguably hip hop is a lot of Jamaican American folks who really opened the door for that music to happen. Biggie Smalls, his mother, I believe, is Jamaican, right? And so you start to, it's more than just one thing, and this has been going on for a very long time, and really looking, and sometimes that's what I have to say as people are really thinking about the conversations towards reparations, like who's gonna get that, right? Y'all weren't here building this stuff, and I'm like, you don't know that. Like, you don't know that. You don't know when someone's immigrant story began, right? So we need to be, there has to be a wisdom there. The Schomburg in Harlem, he was Puerto Rican, right? He's Afro-Latinx. And so there's all of these things that, like, is there dynamics to these things? And so when we start to get too siloed and too singular about things, I think we really lose people's contributions.
We're going to take a quick pause and continue the conversation when we return. The Labyrinth of the First Gen would like to announce a call to action. We hope that you are currently enjoying the show, and we want to hear feedback from you. So if you are listening on this show on any of iTunes platforms, Spotify, as well as Google Podcasts, please rate the show. Let us know what you think. And as they say, sharing is caring. So share this episode with a friend.
And we are back. This is the Labyrinth of the First Gen.
I want to hear from you around the perspective of being first gen. And are there significant differences when you're thinking about people that have been here for generations, right?
I think definitely for sure being first generation, you're not tainted in the harms of this country. Like, you haven't been wrapped all the way in it. So when you come here and what your parents tell you about that experience, like, you're just starting off the generational cycle here. And I don't think people fully understand how harmful this place is the longer you stay here over time. So there was like a protective shield because of being like, you can't waste opportunity. Look what happened. Like, look at these Black Americans that are standing outside the building, you know, growing up the projects. Like, look at these people that don't go to school and are drinking and all of these things. And sometimes you're judging the individual. But also as a public health person, also knowing that, like, it only takes about, I think, two generations, the research shows, for those same kind of, like, institutional and structural ills to start to affect our communities, too. Do I feel like we have a little bit of a protective shield in some sense? Yes, because it's both a blessing and a curse that you're taught to be better than the Black Americans on U.S. soil and is used as a motivation stimuli. Like, don't mess this up because look what could happen. Look at them. They don't buy no homes. They don't. And all of these stories are not really rooted fully in fact, right? Because I'm like, well, for even Black people to be here, Black immigrants, like, it was because of the work of African Americans, right? To open up the door for that to even happen, for us to benefit from the policies. All immigrants actually have benefited from the Civil Rights Act. There was even a story about the way it opened it up for Indian Americans, right? There was an article about that. And so there was just, again, not enough recognition, but also because we're not really looking at, like, the larger powers that be, that really we need to be questioning them, we start to peel apart one another. So within the Black community, I hear a lot of xenophobic comments. Xenophobia is big, right? Like, people are like, look at these immigrants and la da da da. And I have to be like, hey, like, I'm from an immigrant family, or really peeling back, where does that come from? When you hear people, you know, kind of ready to disparage. And then I hear the other side of immigrant groups too, also disparaging. So nobody is completely innocent in that. And then we're not really talking about why we're even in this conundrum in the first place with limited opportunities. And so I definitely see the way that my immigrant status, people are often like, oh, I know you weren't, like, African-American. There's something different about you. And I'm like, I could tell. Yeah, I could tell you're not from here, you know, like. Sometimes even I get from other Black people, they're like, oh, from your features, I knew you weren't, like, Black, African-American. I always find that fascinating because sometimes I can tell, too, from features. When I see somebody, I'm like, oh, you're, like, from blah, 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 right? So that's also really interesting to know. But, yeah, people, this definitely has been a privilege in some senses because people assume a little bit more highly of you than if you said you were Black American, especially I feel in the Northeast. I do think there's different dynamics going on down South. Like, there's a beauty in going down there and seeing so many, like,
you know, the HBCUs are down there. There's a lot of Black professionals, people who've been on the higher echelons of Black society for a long time. You know, so I think there's a different dynamic with the Northeastern stuff too.
How do these dynamics, when we're talking about acknowledging that, you know, there are even, you know, separations between Black immigrants and Black times African American, how do these dynamics show up in the spaces that you have been in, whether that be in school, work, or outside of that?
I definitely think, like, being in some of the spaces, predominantly white institutions and things that I've been in, I notice that most of the Black people I see, or a good number of them, are not African American. I noticed this even in grad school when I was on the diversity steering community there, and we were really sitting with the powers that be and being like, why is it that we don't have people, you know, from Roxbury and Dorchester and these Black areas? Hell, we didn't even have people from Chinatown applying, right? Because the Black people that were at my public health program and in the medical schools, they were not African American. A lot of them were Caribbean. A lot of them were Nigerian, Ghanaians, right? And so, like, you start to see it. I see it when I work with organizations across the board. You'll see Black people, you know, from their name that they're not Black people from U.S. soil. Advice based on your experience and even thinking about the work that you do today that you would give any first gen person, whether they are from an immigrant background or they're folks around the world that are trying to pave a path for themselves and in future. I think that, you know, that we're not crazy. Like, there's a weight that we carry. And sometimes I'm even reading back some of my old journal entries and I'm like, wow, I've been having kind of like a lot of a negative self-talk for a very long time because it feels like there's this immense responsibility. It feels like the world can feel really unkind, like you're efforting and you're still not completely, you know, maybe where you want to be, right? Or there's so much resistance all the time and you're constantly going uphill. So I think recognizing that the world is a difficult place, and I think it's important to remind ourselves about, like, the mountains that we've already climbed. That's what I'm reminding myself now. I'm like, wow, like, you know, you're a Black woman from one of the largest housing projects, and you were able to purchase an apartment. That wasn't an easy feat. Being Black, they make it very difficult for people to own property. And our people have owned property in this country. And this is why they continuously fight to take it away from us, because it's so important. Ownership is so important. And so, you know, really thinking about the hills you have to climb, because sometimes you're already looking at the next hill. And I think that really can contribute to, like, spiritual and mental dysmorphia, not really being able to, like, see the fruits of our labor. So I think it's important to know that, yeah, you're not crazy for feeling that way, but also how do I, like, make more room for kind of, like, rest and celebration? I think that's very important. I think another piece of wisdom is, you know, no one talks to us about workplaces until we're in them and you're going through the dynamics. I even think about what our father went through. You know, sometimes I look at his old resumes and him coming home, and there's so many stories that our loved ones go through as they go in to make money to survive. And I think about those stories too, and it pains my heart, right? And, like, so you like, I want six figures and I want this, things that, like, our parents were not even able to accomplish. But you think about the cost of that too on your psyche and on your spirit. Like, it's not easy being in these spaces at all. So it's like, sometimes I'm really thinking about, like, how do we pave new ways to new, like, ways of existing, or tap back into some of the ways that were already established for us by some of the trailblazers that made it possible to be here. You know, like, there've been plenty of people and movements that said, you know, this system doesn't work and we want to do new systems and have new ways. And I want to uncover a little bit more of those stories, because the wisdom is already in the room. about some of the things that, some of the trajectories that we can be on, some of the new ways to look at things, to create other means for ourselves. Even though so many Black entrepreneurship stories, because people had to, like, even like they were like, you know, when slavery was ending, people were like, they had to make way, selling watermelon, selling different things, doing what they can, starting. I was listening to a podcast about a Black family that started a catering business because Black food has always been the heartbeat. There's so much, like so many people I admire had to say, I have to leave these certain environments because I had to save myself or I'm going to end up dead if I don't find another way, if I don't find another environment. So this has been an ongoing thing. And I think a lot of Black people have been questioning this, and we need to continue to question it and continue to tap back into that wisdom of people that are still here and people who still have left beautiful, beautiful work to show us that that was what they were trying to uncover in this process of like, wow, in this really harmful society, like where are some of the beams of light, you know? So where are our beams of light? I have to ask myself that daily.
This episode was produced by me, Wayu Shamika.
I want to say sereme to my beautiful sister, Malika Hodge, for joining us for this episode, and also bring awareness to the work that she's doing now as a humanization strategist. She just launched her own organization, and you can find more information about her, the work that she currently does to better organizations and environments at her Instagram account, Human-Centered Leadership with a C at the end, right? And you can also find her website.
We will be back next week for another episode. But until then, be in peace, folks, and see you later.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.